Hello and welcome to another episode of Monster Dear Monster, a monster exploration podcast where we take a look at monsters from their folkloric origins to their current pop culture incarnations.
Good evening, everybody. I'm your host for this one, Matthew. And well, usually I start off with a joke, but I just can't find one right now for this film. With me tonight is Dave. How you doing, Dave?
I'm doing pretty good.
And Leonard, I know you want to make the joke that everyone makes about this movie, so I'm going to let you do it.
Oh, no, I don't want to make the joke that everyone makes about this movie because it's trite and dumb and old.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And you can't go on Letterboxd without being inundated with, like, I don't know, too many fishfucker jokes. There it is, folks. Tonight's movie is The Shape of Water. Guillermo del Toro directed and screenplay and story and produced everything. Came out in 2017, I believe. What a movie. We wanted to do this. We were talking about it, I think, after the fucking Bye Bye Man podcast, but we're not talking about it anymore. Because Doug Jones needed a redemption arc. Yeah. A correction, And it was funny because, like, when the amphibian man came on screen, I just, like, leaned over to Meg when we were watching him and goes, "That's the Bye Bye Man."
You could see his chin. That's his Bye Bye chin.
The dog's in the water. You can't see it. I watched this movie in theaters when it came out because, like, I was like, oh, man, Del Toro's doing the Abe Sapien movie.
Abe Sapien fan fiction.
Yeah, right? Because, like, this was, like, fresh after, was it the second Hellboy came out? And he still wanted to, like, just, like, work in that world with that character a lot is what I read at the time. And, really liked Doug Jones and all that stuff. So, just kept rocking and rolling with it. I didn't think it would be this movie I walked into theaters.
When I walked into theaters.
But I'm really happy with what this is. It's just like such a, I don't know, how the fuck do you even describe this? This is a noir that feels like a stage play that turns into a musical for a second that is also like this weird, like, transhumanist love story period piece. It's just kind of got its fingers in every pie. It's really, really good. When did you guys first see this?
I first watched this today, so.
Wow, yeah, really? Yeah. No way.
I had wanted to get around to watching it, but I had not seen it until today. Oh,
wow. Yeah. What a treat. What a treat to see this for the first time.
Yeah, it was on the list of things to do, and then I just got swamped with other movies or something. That same thing happened with the Crimson. What the heck was the Crimson one? They're in the house and it's ghosts.
Still, I'm not sure.
Crimson Peak.
Yeah, Crimson Peak. Same thing. I just, like, didn't, it just missed me. And then we watched for the podcast. I was like, oh no, this was really good. I don't know why I didn't watch it.
Huh. Yeah. Yeah, I think this is maybe my third time seeing it. Hmm. I really like this movie a lot. And I think it's because it's the perspective is like really fun. Usually
it's
like
something different for a Cold War spy drama movie.
Right. It's like the machine is the enemy and not the people involved. The people who have like given themselves to the machine are the enemy, like the general, Michael Shannon. But like that Russian spy is like, no, like we're humans. This is a, you know, like you have to do a human thing here. And, you know, for a Cold War film that the Russian guy actually isn't the enemy, which is really cool. And like, it's this big top secret lab and whatever, but it's the person that cleans it, that who it's about, not like the scientist discovering it and having a change of heart or whatever. Right. Like who is usually positioned in the spotlight here. It's just like someone incidental that you don't even think about at a government facility, but is obviously there all the time. Somebody has to empty the waste paper baskets and clean the toilets and do whatever.
Get the mop out. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's
mop
also
all the piss off the floor.
There's also this very, like obvious angle of, the heroes are all these very marginalized people.
Yeah. Yeah.
The people in power are of course comfortable and oblivious to like Michael Shannon is a Michael Shannon's like one of my favorite current day actors working.
He's really good. Yeah.
And but he's always kind of difficult to watch and stuff because he is, really good at playing an asshole, like a believable asshole. And this and his character, it's Sterling, right? I believe Sterling is
Yeah, he's like a misanthrope. He's like so weird.
But he's like he's also like very just like casually racist, casually
he's
sexist.
He's American Psycho,
like,
man. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was gonna say it feels like a Brett
Strickland is his name. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just thinking of this author from Chuck Palahniuk.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Feels like that kind of character where it's just like, what is this dude? He has all these like one-liners and they're just awful.
Yes.
Like, I mean, they work in the movie, but you're like, wow. This guy,
but
you don't want to be
he's
around
the
him.
Fucking cat's pajamas, because no one's allowed to step to him. So he thinks everything he says is deep and meaningful and like proud and loyal and whatever jingoistic shit comes out of him, and no one can say anything to him, you know. And when she actually like tells him to fuck off, she does it in sign language, and he can't understand it, and it frustrates the shit out of him. And yeah, it's just what a character. But you're absolutely right. Leonard, he plays a dude that you love to hate, and he's so good at like just being this like, man, I can't wait to see this guy fucking get his.
Yeah, he's just a toad. Like,
and the thing about it is that he's like oblivious. Like he's the personification of the 60s in like the white man in the 60s like. Like he's not he's so oblivious to how unbelievably awful he is all the time.
Right.
Because that's just the normal for him and men at the time. And it's utterly fascinating. And he's really compelling to watch in this role, even though he is unbelievably despicable at every single turn. Every single time he opens his mouth, I'm like, I'm both enthralled and disgusted by this performance.
Yeah. He's like, he has he's like a little bit of a narcissist, but to the point that he just utterly doesn't care what anyone else thinks.
Right.
Right.
Like everything is so beneath him that he just like, he huffed the largest bag of his own farts.
And yeah, exactly.
Like, this is the best.
There's a point where he's like describing how he likes to torture people by describing the candy that he's been eating throughout the entire film. That everyone else has sophisticated taste, but he found this candy when he was a little kid and he enjoys it and he hasn't felt a need to change ever. And yeah. it is the entire summation of his character. I am a grown child. I do not need to change because the things I like are the correct things to like. And it's this like borderline zealotry of enforcing the status quo of him at the top of the food chain that it's just so it's terrifying. It is
well, his
really
whole,
terrifying.
I mean, just him, like you could sit, we have the space to do this. We can sit and just discuss like all the little things that he says and does and like how that just speaks volumes of like that part of the culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just, it has the feeling. So it's like the growing up through the 40s and 50s and he has the, it is the white picket fence.
Oh yeah. 2.5 kids, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cadillac, I'm obviously not going to cook anything. That's not what I do. Like I bring home the money.
Right.
You know, and the good little kids will do their thing. The women in as a whole should just be seen and not heard. Like he takes that to
he fetishizes a quiet woman. It's woof.
Like to his wife, and then she has other concerns, and he's just like no, shh, shh.
Yeah. Yeah, let me put my rotting
of course,
hand
with the,
your
with
mouth.
The main character who's mute, he's like, I've never seen a more perfect woman. You don't even speak, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like, okay, guy, wow. I will say, I think the thing that just like sent me was when they ran into him in the bathroom, or he came into the bathroom when they were cleaning, the cleaning ladies.
Oh, his introduction?
Yeah.
And he just like takes a leak with his hands on his hips. Yeah.
Well, he washes his hands, then uses the bathroom, and then he's like, what? Don't you understand that, like, that's how you learn about a man or something? It's, you can tell all you need to know about a man by if he washes his hands before or after he uses mm-hmm. the restroom.
Yeah.
And if he washes them before and after, that's just a weak man.
Yes.
And
Jesus
then
Christ.
Yeah, it's just like, hey, my dude. Yeah. Just gotta unplug, turn that nozzle off. You're just
This is early is wiping your butt gay discourse.
Yeah, it's like what?
it's insane.
Yeah. And the thing, you're watching him, and he's just everything he's saying. You can tell that he's like, it's not lip service. He believes, like this garbage.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Like he's bought and sold on it.
But not only that, he's so internalized on it that when that Cadillac salesman says, "You look like a man who's heading towards the future. You look like a man who could be sitting in the seat of a Cadillac driving towards your future right now," he goes, "Yep," and he just buys a Cadillac right there. Like immediately, and because like it is that is what he wants, the platonic
ideal. That does sound right. That is me.
Yeah, that is
but
right.
Without
I
ever
am a man going
saying
to the future.
That he needs that validation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. He's just
He's just like your damn Skippy. Boy. That is mine. He's like, I think you should just give that to me. Mm-hmm. It's obviously my car. You knew it.
The character I equate like him like being a lot like is the Fed in the Iron Giant. That shows up and like stays in the house and whatever, who was like kind of friendly at first, tried to do carrot before stick immediately, and then just became like a psychopathic monster. This is the same guy. It's like there's an archetype of like a 60s spook that is like this, that But he just like is like, no carrot ever. No one needs respect. Everyone has to respect me. Yeah, just what a performance. Really good.
I don't need a carrot. I have this candy. And, you know, if I'm feeling a little bit of anxiety or a little anxious, I can just bite it.
Yeah.
That's all I need. That's my stress relief. That's it. I bite this and then I hit people with batons, stun batons.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Stun batons that I name and know the make of and exactly what they do. And yeah. Ugh. Wild.
Yeah.
The other thing that's fantastic about this film is like, I mean, there's like a lot more characters that are just so deep. Everyone does all these little things. Not only this character, like everyone does all these little. They all have idiosyncrasies.
They all have idiosyncrasies.
I think really, just you can not see them at first. Now on like my third viewing of this, you really see everything and all the little things people do, which is really like fun to watch. But like, basing it like it feels like set and lit and kind of shot like a stage play almost. It's always like the front of something. You always have that like missing fourth wall in every scene. That is pretty interesting. That makes it, that heightened reality just kind of makes sense, the way like a stage play always has sort of heightened reality. The emotions are a little bit higher. People like outright say what they think and mean a lot. And it just adds to this, like, this pastiche that it's doing right now of, like, exactly that. Like, a noir drama stage play mixture thing that, I don't know. I've really never seen a lot like this out there since. And if there's more out there that you can recommend to me,
but they're not,
throw them at me.
Like, they're probably French films.
Yeah, right? No, that's the feeling, man. Exactly.
I mean, there's also the aspect of, oh my God, oh, these are sets. Oh, look, they made a thing and then filmed it instead of like some weird green screen that or projection screen that makes you feel like you're on Andor or whatever. And I'm just like, ah, set design, lighting.
Wow.
Oh, look at my babies. Because like whenever I see stuff like that, especially like the lab where they keep the amphibian man, I'm just like, I'm reminded of the Penguin's lair from Batman Returns. Because I'm just like, look at this space that is real and functional, essential, like functional, big air quotes, because, you know, it's a real thing. And it's just like, I love that there's like, it's tangible and doesn't look like fake CG nonsense.
Right. Yeah. Everything's like real and oppressively real.
Yes.
The way these places like work there, there's no consideration for the livability of these spaces. In a lot of them, it's very hostile as compared to like, you know, the homes that were these like hostile attics that Elisa and her neighbor Giles, they live in above a movie theater. It's loud. It leaks. It doesn't look great. Like everything's cracked and sort of molded and whatever. But it looks like such a warm and inviting and cozy spot because it's like lived in versus
it's lived
like,
in. And yeah. It's green.
It's green. Everything's like green.
It's green lit.
Yeah. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Giles is a great character. You don't see a lot of characters like this, and he is this thread through this story that isn't hammered on really hard, but it's exactly what you said, Leonard. It is like these like oppressed groups, these like separate marginalized groups. And at the very beginning of the film, there is race riots on television, and he goes, turn that off. I can't look at it. I can't see it. Turn it off. Turn it off. Turn it off. And as the film goes on and he sees the consequences of turning a blind eye against things like that, shit starts to fall down around him. And it's never like, you know, directly said that he has had to come to terms with the fact that he's been hiding. And it's when he does, you know, his character turn and decides to help her free the amphibian man. But, you know, he sees like the dude he's been flirting with at the pie shop turns out to be, you know, this homophobic, racist monster fella. And yeah, just the world falls down around his ears. And because he has decided not to pay attention to any of that until it came home. Right.
Right.
I just love his little story beats and how it goes and how he's such a person who's willing to live and forgive. Like one of his cats gets eaten and he's not mad. He's just like, ah, well, you can't blame him. You know, it's an animal. It's going to eat something.
And then just looking at his general situation, I mean, he's literally, and he calls it out. He's like, I am a starving artist. Like, mm-hmm. You know,
yeah,
this is what I am. Because this, you know, the system and his, the companies and everything, he just got let go.
Yeah. Oh, it's a dying medium. He's doing, drawn print ads, and everyone wants to move to photography because photography is the new thing in advertising. And he is refusing to let go of a world that is closing down around him.
Right.
It's, yeah.
Yeah. And it's just, I mean, it's a craft that he's honed his whole life. And he's like, this is a great piece. I worked really hard on this. And, you know, mm-hmm. they were like, yeah, I mean, you did, but it's not what we want. It's not what the, you know, the advertisers want.
Right. Yeah. I love how every time he finishes anything, he goes, I think this is my best work yet. I think that's a really good attitude to have as an artist, and I should probably adopt that. Just like anytime I make anything. You know? Yeah. This is my best work yet.
He's great. He has a lot of, like, he's just a nice guy.
Yeah.
As a person.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And he just has they have a lot of quiet moments, and it's like, he's an older guy, barely can't really support himself. It's hard to take care of himself. And there's some of that, like, he's a creative guy and they kind of made him a little quirky, but it's not something like he's not blind to things. He's just willingly not looking at stuff.
Yeah. He's making the decision to not.
Yeah.
Look. Yeah.
Because, mm-hmm. because he's aside from like not having employment, like steady employment, he feels safer in his little world where he's in control of like these couple little variables.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, don't have to leave. Don't have to go do stuff. Sometimes I get to go see a movie cause the theater guy likes me. The landlord.
Yeah. Landlord's great. Come see Bible movies. Nobody likes them. Come on. I'll give you free tickets.
Yeah, you get candy popcorn.
So good. Yeah, yeah. And like he keeps going to that pie shop that has like the shittest pie ever that like
it's the and then he like he I mean because he's going there just to flirt
and he has a fridge full of leftover pie.
Yeah He's like, maybe we won't eat these, and he opens up the fridge and you see like there's like 10 of them in there.
Right.
It's like, my dude, you can throw those out,
because he's refusing to see like he
yeah
he
yeah never, no for sure
yeah it's such a good arc and such a subtle thing.
Well, because he's still like, it's to the level where he's denying that the pie is bad also.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, he's like, you know, it's not the best, but it's fine. And it's just full of dye. Like, it's
just... Yeah, it just looks like shit. It's such a confusing pie shop, too. It's called Dixie Doug's, right? And the mascot is Italian. So yeah. They make them talk in a southern accent.
It's a maybe a little Italian man.
There was a radio ad. And
okay.
And you hear a radio ad as one of the cars pulls up, and you hear, it's a good pie. And then it's like, Nixon Dugs. And it's the same ad. And it's like, this is cacophonous. Why are you doing this? It's like, so it doesn't know what it wants to be.
Well, just like our heroes, our main cast.
Right. Yeah.
This is the whole movie is everyone like, not finding themselves, but coming to terms with where they're at.
Right. Yeah. Like
everybody has to come to like a come to Jesus moment for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And his, even though he's like a smaller character, his was wiping the taste of pie out of his mouth at the pie shop, leaving the art he just got denied there, and just walking out and making a decision. He was just like, I'm wiping the taste of this out of my mouth. I am done pretending, and moves on. And it's just such a powerful little scene. It's really good. And like you said, he has like this routine with Eliza, our main character, who is mute, which was a very cool touch. You don't see that a lot in films, and the way they handle it is very well. And it kind of shows the merry-go-round of life with the two of them in their idiosyncrasies. Like I think the opening scene is just her day and getting ready for work and what she does at work and visiting him, and like same routine every day, same egg timer to know when the eggs are done, taking the same bath every day. Just the constant, like, both comfort and loneliness of a schedule.
Yeah, I mean, because there's so you can be lonely and be okay because you're comfortable in your routine. You have a routine.
Yeah, a creature comfort.
Now, deviating from that can, like, be good and bad. Mm-hmm. And I think both those things both exist at the same time for all of these characters. One, you know, right. Once they deviate from their norm, some good things happen and then a lot of bad things happen.
Right.
Big, you know, roller coaster of stuff because one thing changed. You know, one small change changed everybody's lives.
Right. Yeah. Like when you look for like writing 101 themes in this, the man versus nature is like huge there on top because, but the role is a little reversed. You think that the nature is the amphibian man, and that is like what's challenging the norm, but it's not. Because every human here is acting like a rat in a maze every single day of their life. And then this thing shows up, and it's like, actually, you can be more than that. You know, you can be, you know, this thing that travels the globe and is worshipped and is like transcendent and above the rest of us. But because we're so stuck thinking that, oh, you need to eat this like shit meatloaf for lunch every day and, you know, whatever, that, you know, we're the smarter ones because we have society all figured out where we put this dumb military dude at the top of our hierarchy or something. It's just, it's such a reversal of the roles in that man versus nature thing that I don't know. I really like this movie and what it is deciding to do and what it's deciding to say. About just, I don't know, human contact in general. I know there was a little bit of controversy about the use of a mute person because of specifically her falling in love with the amphibian man, because they said, you know, she has this line where it's like, he sees me for me, not what I'm missing, and because he also is the same. And people were saying that line kind of meant that people with disabilities need to meet other people with similar disabilities to find love or equality or companionship that can understand them fully. And like, while I can understand that take, I really don't think that's the direction that this film was going in at all.
No.
It was more,
I mean, we
like,
don't, yeah. We don't do like spoiler walls or anything, but doesn't really pan out that way. Like,
no. Not at all. Yeah.
Also, there is the implication that she has a greater connection to this to the amphibian man ultimately at the end of this film anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
I don't think, yeah, it's not even an implication. It's like,
yeah. It's, found it's on like the riverside. Text. Yeah, yes. Found by the riverside with scars on her neck, you know, it's the same. Yeah. And it just, they're similar from the very beginning, right? Like, she eats, like, a pile of eggs every day. You know, she's eating eggs for breakfast and making an egg salad sandwich for lunch, and, like, the first thing she shows this thing is an egg, and it's like, holy shit, I love those things, and just, like, goes for it, you know? And it's just, that's just, like, the beginning of, like, oh, wait, why are they so similar kind of things. But
this just a quick tangent. This actually does bring up something that I kind of enjoyed mulling over in the periphery of, hey, what if there are Lovecraftian elements divorced from the like existential horror and nightmarish cosmic horror of Lovecraft completely? Because there's no elder gods, there's no Cthulhu, it's just just an amphibian man. She might be she's an adjacent amphibian human hybrid, since we don't get any history on her. I'm like, oh, it's actually really interesting to see like these concepts that we are very familiar with, like divorce from it. Like, this isn't the shadow over Innsmouth.
Yeah. It's... Well, what if the Innsmouth look was like being half Italian or something? It's just a thing that happens.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's unfortunately, that's the read that Lovecraft was going with.
I know, but like
when I was watching this, that's what I was immediately thinking of, was that, oh, this is a reframing of Shadow Over Innsmouth, because Del Toro wasn't able to do In the Mountains of Madness,
right?
He was like, I want to do my stuff, but we're just gonna use things from stuff I've already done, and here we go. Yeah, because that's how it read to me, like, at the end. And not that it's Lovecraftian, but we have, like, a fishman god, and then, like, a member of the folks who follow that god, maybe?
Oh, yeah.
Hybrid? Yeah. It doesn't matter.
Well, they said, that he was taken from South America and whatever, and she has, you know, a Spanish last name from... Yeah. Where was her orphanage? Like, Colombia or something like that? So...
I think so. Yeah. Because her last name just means orphan.
Yeah.
Right.
So, probably a descendant of the line or something like that. That just, you know, it's... a very small touch, but still fun to pull those threads and to try to solve.
Yeah. Because, I mean, like I said, ultimately it doesn't specifically matter, but there's enough little threads to go, oh, that you can make suppositions, and I don't think they're like horrendously off the mark.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Also, you know, there's the joy of it, you know, it would piss Lovecraft off if I could take a DeLorean and show Lovecraft The Shape of Water, that would, A, kill him immediately, but also make him quite angry before he succumbed to, like, madness. Whatever brain hemorrhage the movie would cause.
Right.
he learned the unknowable.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting love story framed with like a Cold War setting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like it's the folks that were like they're already on the periphery, and all of the crap going on between the US and Russia, like it's generational, like it damaged a lot of people.
Yeah. It instilled the inability to accept the other in like,
yeah,
you know,
no, I mean, well, it's not even the ability other. To accept. It's like it instilled the thing of fear.
Yeah.
Of the other.
But yeah. And it's dealing with othering in a bunch of different ways, and how like one sector of society is like, we are the other and we have to, you know, love and work with and be the other together.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the status quo is like, no, we gotta, you know, it's a Cold War romance movie where both the US and Russia are wrong, but not in the way Cold War romance movies kind of like put, you know, dots on those I's and cross those T's. It's in a very different way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which, yeah. Good stuff.
Like, I also enjoy the scientist/Russian spy who's completely and utterly done with the cloak and dagger bullshit.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He's like, you had me sitting on a cinder block for a fucking hour, and I always end up at this stupid restaurant. Just have me come here.
Yeah, and the bodyguard just like isn't interested in saying the password back to him, and yes, won't even turn the fucking engine off on the Studebaker they're driving so you can hear him. And it's just
the goose lays its egg at midnight, and then he's just like, what?
Huh? Yeah. Fuck it, whatever.
He's like, come on, you're making me scream. This is not a very good password if I'm having to scream my half of the code phrase.
Right. And then, like, for everything that happens between them, both powers decide, well, it's better that nobody has it, so we're just going to kill it. Right. And, yeah, it's just, like, we have this, like, opportunity to, like, learn and grow. They didn't even know it could heal things. Like, they didn't know anything about it other than it was a fish man. Even though,
oh yeah, they didn't care. Like that yeah, was that wasn't ever like, the
plugs it with three shots and it's fine. And I was like, wait, what the fuck? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't care. Didn't care about that.
Well, and he's been like beating the crap out of it and zapping it. And it obviously would have just been like, oh, it's fine.
Yeah,
I healed myself immediately.
Right. And they only want to, like, you know, a hammer only sees nails. They only want to push it towards the space race. They don't care about what it can do for anything else.
Yeah, no, they're specifically like, oh, we need to have something that can prepare our astronauts for long term in different environment, like hostile environments.
Right. Yeah.
We should cut it open.
We should cut it open. Make a helmet out of it. It's like,
see, it's two different lungs. Why not?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you can't x-ray them because of the cartilage. It's like, okay.
Yep.
And then the spy scientist, he's like, I want to study it that doesn't involve vivisection. Like, it's alive and there's only one of them. If you kill it, that's it. Like, that's it.
And the only reason he knows any of the humanities studies that have been on it is because he sits in the dark and he watches Eliza, like, give it eggs and play it Buddy Holly records and shit.
Yeah, he's like it enjoys music and culture and it's learning language. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, none of those things were being done by, like, science. It was through, like, genuine human connection.
Yeah, all the scientists were doing were, like, feeding it hot dogs and, like, putting it in pressurized tubes. And, like, they just really didn't care what the hell was going on with this. Yeah. I mean, in terms of plot, not a lot happens here. We get introduced to a fish man. One of the cleaning staff falls in love with him. The army decides to cut it open instead of, like, study it. She kidnaps it. Well, she doesn't kidnap it. She frees it. Yeah, breaks it out. Keeps it in her bathroom, falls in love with it, and then tries her best to let him go when there's enough water to let it swim out of the canal. And that's it. That's it. But
yeah.
It's not a ton going on. There isn't like a huge heist. There isn't like tons of planning. It's a very small heist that fucks up immediately because they're not professionals.
No, it's just it's the line cooks, the janitor staff,
mm-hmm.
An out of work artist,
mm-hmm. yep,
and tangentially a Russian spy.
Right. At this point, yeah, he's a defector from both nations. He's just like, no, this.
He's like, what? Okay, look, I just care about the fish man. Like, let's not kill it.
Yep. And all the parties are all barely aware of each other too.
They have no idea. Like, they know that that can exist, but they're just like, their eyes aren't on like Earth. The space race is all,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's something's going down. And then Michael Shannon's character, he's just like, there was an operation. Give me their how many, give me their ranks. Give me this. Yeah. And the guy's like, there's none of that. There's
had to be a strike team of 10 had to be a strike team of 10.
The strike team, give me all the info. And he's like, you've been gut shot anyway. You're just going to die. So why don't you just tell me? Do yourself a favor. And the guy's like,
yeah, it's all the people that you just ignored. And
because
that's right. Who you are.
Yeah, everyone you've been
about
shitting
what
on.
God looks like. Yeah. It may be more like me than like you is how God
man,
looks.
That was...
Oh, man. Woof.
Yeah.
Yikes, man. That's rough.
I was just like, wow. Once again, and it's one of those things where like I'm so used to like the cartoonishly like overblown internet produced like racism, sexism, misogyny, blah blah blah.
Yeah. No, this is like the microaggression.
Yeah.
Like, death by a thousand cuts, and not being very overt. He's just saying shit like it's normal.
Right, because it is normal
for him.
It is normal. Yeah, it is normal.
I mean, like he's saying stuff offhand, like he's so up his own ass, he's not actually being mean about anything.
Right.
For the most part.
Yes.
He's just a tool bag.
Whatever comes in, pops into his head because he is allowed to say just.
Yeah, because no one's. Yeah, we've covered that. I mean, no one's going to. Who's going to tell him no?
Right.
Right. But like, but he's so blinded by it. Like, you know, during the investigation, everybody has to show credentials and whatever after the amphibian man's been let go or has been freed. And he's like, not the staff, though, not the cleaning staff, but just let them punch in because they have to get to work. It couldn't possibly be them. They're a bunch of, you know, dumb, you know, women and whatever.
And they don't even have – that was sending me.
They don't even have ID.
You know, it's a secret facility. They don't have, like, security clearances or things. And they're just they have, like, full run of this facility with secret things going on.
And if you think this is, like – a silly thing that happens in a movie, it's not.
It's not.
What was the thing? The British embassy in Hong Kong recently had to release all of its cleaning and wait staff because they're all traditionally, quote, you know, quotes, British that love their traditions, all local Chinese people to clean and to change the bedding and whatever of the embassy staff at the British embassy in Hong Kong. And it turns out almost all of them were spies. Isn't that weird? And Britain was like, we had no idea. We had no idea.
Who could have possibly imagined?
I know, right? We were just hiring the locals. That's a good British tradition, right? To have them, you know, wipe
they
our
were the colony.
And stuff.
Why would they spy?
Yeah. Yeah. So this shit still happens today because,
People
man, oh, man. Because we all know. We all know why. But yeah, and
because
even,
of this, because of Michael Shannon,
because of Michael Shannon. But to even like get to the point where he finds out it's the cleaning staff, like was just a coincidence.
No,
right?
It's like the denouement. It's like the his final moments is him going, oh,
yeah,
wow, I feel stupid.
Yeah,
I
feel stupid. And not only that, he goes after the wrong member of the cleaning staff because he's like, oh, it has to be the black woman. You know, because the other one I've got my eye on, it couldn't possibly be her. It
can't be her. She's quiet.
Right. Yeah. No. She is incapable.
Exactly.
And if it wasn't for Zelda's like shithead husband, Brewster, who she's been like shit talking this entire time. And when you actually get to meet him, woof.
Yeah, he's actually worse than she's portrayed.
Yeah. Because you think it's just like this, like, oh, like a Carl Winslow type. You think he's just like a, you know, like a sitcom dad who's just kind of shitty and like whatever. But no, like this is like terrifyingly cold. Hasn't talked in years. Who like just totally throws her under the bus.
Yeah, immediately.
And immediately. You think this dude is going to stand up and kick this shit out of Michael Shannon, because he could. He's huge. But no. Sits right back down in his chair, keeps watching TV. Doesn't give a shit. Oh, what a scene. That was a really good scene.
Yeah.
And so, flips, yeah, and that's the only reason Michael Shannon gets pointed in the correct direction for the very end of the film. And then takes a fucking 2x4 to the face, which was very satisfying. Yeah, that whole ending is really good because, like, it's just he's just becoming more increasingly unhinged, which is, like, shown through his fingers rotting off his hand. Because at the very beginning of the film, you know, in like the first 15 minutes or whatever, he gets attacked by the creature off screen, fires a couple shots into it, and gets two fingers bit off, which the cleaning staff find and give back to him. And I guess, yeah, she puts it in the bag that her egg salad sandwich is in, so it gets mustard on him, which is great. And they sew him back on. He's like, I'm fine. I just need to keep this wrapped up and keep taking pain pills for it. And they just get more and more gangrenous. They ooze pus. Yeah. And then when he finally completely snaps, he rips his fingers off of his hand. It's just a wonderful, like thermostat to how rotten this dude has become mentally and physically throughout the film.
It's kind of a nice mirror to the general stepfather in Pan's Labyrinth when he gets his cheek slashed and we get that wonderful shot of him sewing his mouth back together. I'm like, mm-hmm. Yes, now you are obviously the monsters outside that you have always been on the inside. Congratulations, you have become the not normal. Now you are in fact now a marginalized person, even though you will never see it.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, you get the last minute like light bulb.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Particularly here. Oh, you are a god.
Yeah.
That's it. It's like, okay. Yep. You didn't get a lot of good lines in this movie.
Then he gets his throat ripped out, which goddamn, so good. So good. And like the story he keeps telling about Samson and Delilah, about a woman being the downfall of a man, which it's going to happen because it's happening to him right now. And specifically using the Philistines, which were like the Samaritans, like settlers in the same area of like Egypt and things like that, but not from there. They were foreign. And that's why they are so derided in the Bible and stuff, because it's like, oh, these foreign people with their foreign gods and their foreign ways and their different color skin. And, you know, it's exactly what's happening on screen. You know, he's like, yeah, no, you are surrounded by Philistines because they are not your people, man. They are other than you. And, you know, get out. What are you doing? It was just a really good, like, biblical historical alignment of the story he thought he was telling, but only because that story was told by the quote-unquote victors and not the actual telling of, you know, the historical truth of what was happening there.
Right.
Just good, deep, wonderful, wonderful stuff.
Awesome. My favorite thing about that is the reason he even starts telling her that story to begin with is because he asks what the D in her for her middle name stands for. So mm-hmm. It's just like, yeah, I didn't name myself. Why am I suddenly getting this dissertation about Delilah and the Philistines?
Right.
Fucking piece of shit.
Because like, he feels like he knows better, even right. though it's a complete misunderstanding of the history. It's just chef's kiss. Beautiful shit.
Yeah, we do get the fun like bookend narrative.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Giles telling a story.
Yeah, and it's very nice because he's just like, did they survive? I'd like to think so. Were they in mm-hmm. love? Yeah, probably.
Yeah,
and it's like, this just reminds me of a poem. I will conclude with that.
Right. It's good. It really puts a button on it. In the, like, sort of like the third act, beginning of the third act, when Eliza goes into the musical number, which is the only time she speaks and then sings in the film. That was just, like, such... It was a lot of fun. Shot beautifully, black and white. This like big flashy, like, you know, Fred Astaire style dance number with like a ballroom gown and a big band and everything, proclaiming to be, you know, so in love, but there's a monster dancing with her, was just like, yeah, I like to think that they were in love. And then, but also we get to see that scene, which if that is from Eliza's point of view, yeah, they definitely were, but I don't know, something about that when I first saw it in the theater, I was just like, I don't know about that dance scene with a monster. That was like a little silly, but upon this last watch, I was like, this is fantastic. This is like, if you need to I don't know.
But that's like her romantic heart.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, it is. But it was really putting a pin in the fact that, like, what we do to show we are in love vis-a-vis giant Fred Astaire-style dance scenes is just as insane as a giant Fred Astaire dance scene with a creature from the Black Lagoon.
Right.
Right? Like, it's just so surreal no matter how you slice it. And it's like, yeah, why isn't there, like, Beastmen in all of these? Sure, let's do it. I don't know. That just really, really tickled me this time. And when he says, I'd like to think they were in love, I was like, all right, man, you needed to see that dance scene.
He didn't get to see it. No. I loved, though, when they would, like, watch TV in his apartment, and then they do their little, like, tap dance foot
mm-hmm. dance. Their shuffle ball chain on the floor.
Yeah, it's very cute.
Yes. It's very good. Yeah. And her just, like, tapping in the hallway on her way out, and
yeah,
just to show the use of her, like, footwear to show her mood and how things were changing. In the beginning, she had, like, a black hair, what are those things? Hairband. And, like, she's polishing her black shoes. And then after she loves this creature for the first time, shiny red shoes, red hairband, red lipstick. All of a sudden, the color tone of the movie starts to change a little bit from, like, these dark, dreary browns and greens and yellows, and there's this pop of red everywhere that is, like, the, you know, the symbol of love and whatever, but, like, just real subtle stuff that was really good. And she does, when she's walking somewhere with those red shoes, she just does this tiniest, tiniest dance move. And it's, yeah, I love whenever they pepper those in. Really, really good stuff. But yeah, I don't know how much more I probably could talk about this movie a lot more, because there's just, like, so many just little tiny wonderful things. I like how all of his cats were named after gods. Persephone gets eaten, which oops. Pandora gets eaten. That's right, Pandora gets eaten. Persephone and Thor are still alive.
There's only one way to put Pandora back in the box.
I know, right? And poor Giles, like, I don't know, if someone ate my dog, I'd be pretty upset. I'd understand if it was, like, an animal and didn't know what to do and whatever, like, I could,
yeah, I mean, you'll still be upset
eventually, but before that happens, you know, I'm gonna be a little mad.
I mean, you can't, so that, I don't think that that's incidental that Pandora was eaten, because the way the movie ends, neither the Russians nor the Americans get the secret, the weapon.
Right.
He's back home, he's free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, like, that part did, like, whatever potential weaponization, because, you know, that's what it was going to be specifically, right. Mm-hmm. It isn't unleashed.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's probably it. I think we can wrap it up. It's a fantastic movie.
Yeah.
As we mentioned, it's real straightforward.
Right.
It wears everything flavor on its sleeve. You don't have to, like, you can get everything, I think, from one watch of this, but it's such a well done movie that a second one is not going to hurt you.
Right.
Yeah. Or third.
And if you like character actors, like, Richard Jenkins is Giles, who is just fantastic.
He's fantastic. And the entire time, all I could think of was that he's really upset that his son crashed his yacht. And he just wanted to make it to the Catalina wine mixer.
He's got to get there.
He's got to get there. He lost his way. He lost his business. He's now living above a movie theater.
It's so freaking good. Octavia Spencer is Zelda, who is, like, you know, the companion who gives a lot of voice to our main character. Who she's great and everything. She's very funny. And then freaking Nick Searcy as General Hoyt, who is a general in everything he does. He's in Justified, right? He's the older series of Justified. He's like the head of the Marshal's office or whatever. He's freaking fantastic in that. Just a who's who in this movie. It's a very small cast, but they're all just doing it to the nines. Really good. And Doug Jones, redemption arc, Doug Jones, no longer the Bye Bye Man.
Yeah. Thank you, Doug Jones. I mean, listen, Doug Jones is fantastic in everything that he's in, except for the Bye Bye Man, which was just a squandering of his talents. But yeah, I'm sure he's like, oh, legally distinct Abe Sapien, huh? Okay, sure, I'm down for it.
No problem.
He's like, I don't have the goggles, you know.
And my specific shout out, even though I've talked him up this entire episode, really, Michael Shannon is an unbelievably perfect piece of shit in this movie. it's hard to make a character as despicable as him, like, actually interesting to watch, because he can turn off a lot of people, but his weird mannerisms and his ego and everything really kind of comes together to make for this shitty melange of a human being that gets exactly what he deserves at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you're looking for more Michael Shannon, you can find him in Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, playing General Zod.
Yes. You can also find him in a good movie called Knives Out.
That's true, yeah. I was just trying to think of what else he was in, and that's the only one that came to mind. I'm broken in a way that can't be fixed. Wow, according to his Wikipedia, he was in Jonah Hex. Damn. So he's been in DC movies for a while now. Fantastic. All right.
I mean, you can skip that one, but
yeah, otherwise... you can. I don't know. There's a fun snake man in Jonah Hex. I really like the snake man. Anyway. I think we can put a pin in it. This fish is fried. We are done. If you haven't seen this movie, folks, go watch it. There's no way we could do it justice just talking about the scenery and the set design and the lighting.
It looks so good. It's a good soundtrack, too.
So good.
It's
just a fantastic.
There's
soundtrack.
A lot of show tunes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Great stuff. Great stuff.
Yeah. Once again, proving that it is very it is difficult and kind of boring for us to talk about a good movie on this podcast, because how many times and how many different ways can you just say this movie is good? And
it's good. Yeah. Leonard, it's the dose that makes the poison here. And if we just
wrestled about an hour out of it, actually.
if we only lived on Tubi Trash, we would all, like, you know, have gout or something awful by
now.
Oh,
no, not me. Not me. So.
Feasting for days.
Little piggy rolling around in it, having a great time.
Like, I'm just like, I've returned to the live stream. This garbage, that blows over me.
Oh, we got a Sephiroth apologist. He was right.
My
stream is
right,
full of trash, and I love it.
I'm not saying he's right. I'm just saying I'm right there with him. Being the problem.
Wonderful. All right. If you want to find us, we are in all the normal locations. MonsterDeer.monster online. You can find all of us here on Blue Sky at various different handles. That are on the website, I think.
They're all in the show notes.
Great. Or in the show notes. And are we announcing next week?
We will be returning technically to the Ghostbusters, because we've covered all of it on a previous two guest episodes. It's been a while. It's been a minute, but we did do Ghostbusters 1 and 2. Afterlife, and Hear the Call?
Answer
the Call.
So I've seen the Lady Ghostbusters, but I've not seen the Stranger Things Ghostbusters 1, so I'm going into this blind.
I think you should still be able to watch this new one. I haven't seen it yet, but it's a follow-up to with the Afterlife.
Sure. Right. I just heard that there was CGI Harold Ramis in the last one, and I was like,
"As a tribute, it's very well done."
It's well done. All right.
Yeah.
All right. I'll take your word on that one. We're gonna talk about Ghostbusters next.
It'll
week.
We ain't afraid of no ghost.
Hell yeah! I gotta convince some of my D&D crew to go see Ghostbusters with me. have a little movie date. It's gonna be great. All right, folks, have a good night. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye, everyone.
Monster Dear Monster is brought to you by Fireheart Media. If you enjoyed the show, please share this and all of our episodes with friends. And remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform of choice. Word of mouth is the only way we grow. If you like, you can also kick us a few bucks to help us keep the lights on at ko-fi.com/Fireheart Media. Check out our other show, Jolichon's Place, at www.jolichon.place.